Welcome to part two of Woomera Stories. Woomera Stories features historic and recent audio recordings with refugees and activists recorded from protests and breakouts at the Woomera Detention Centre in 2002. Some archival audio is from Scar TV and Journeyman, featuring music from Combat Wombat, Monkey Mark and the Amelie soundtrack.
A long way up for the free, what once was their home is now a war zone. Under the dictatorship, hypocrisy, their only chance was to flee to a foreign
land. Woomera was built out in the desert, 5 hours from the nearest city and at the end of a closed road. In summer, temperatures often passed 50 degrees centigrade. Across the compound, most of Woomera's Afghan detainees are on hunger strike. The man on the razor wire says that if he can't see the Department of Immigration about his visa, he'll kill himself.
Because I'm not like Saddam Hussein. I am opposite to Saddam Hussein. Now, I am here in this camp 19 months ago.
How did you end up in Woomera? Or how did you find yourself there?
I was expecting, you know, they're going to take me somewhere, but not like a prison camp. But then I got there at 3:30 a.m. and it was too dark. I couldn't see anything. And in the morning when I woke up, I was like, oh, the razor wire. I'm coming back to prison again. It took me maybe another couple of months to adjust the place. Where I am actually, because I didn't know where I am. So it took me a couple of months to find myself, oh, I'm actually in a prison camp. And eventually I forgot my name, because you get the number, and that's my number, it's still with me, in for my bicycle lock number. Oh, now you know my phone, my bank. Everything is at that number.
Spud's Roadhouse at the junction of the roads to Woomera and Roxby. It was a very authentic Aussie roadhouse. They still ran on old diesel generators as the giant power lines that marched through the desert from Port Augusta to Roxby bypassed the remote roadhouse, providing them no power connection, even though their marching metal monsters carrying the power stomped through the middle of their establishment. We used to collect the fish and chip cooking oil from the back of Spuds to run our veg oil vans and trucks. The old guy that lived there was also working on running generators from old sump oil and cooking oil and whatever he could find, and we had chats about such things. I saw many stranger sights at Spud Roadhouse, giant water cannons mounted on bulletproof vehicles pulling into refill, heading, I assume, to Woomera. We found old ammunition boxes and disused weapons and bits of missiles in their rubbish tip. We saw giant pieces of mining machinery on its way to Roxby Downs. There was a Mad Max apocalyptic vibe down there at the best of times. We had come down from up at the camp at Lake Eyre. I was in the process of filming a movie called Too Deadly about uranium mining. It was a B-grade musical spectacular. For the next scene, we wanted to recreate a protest scene at Roxby Downs. So we figured we may as well go down there and do the real thing. So we headed down to Roxby. It was getting late, and after restocking at Roxby with a dumpster mission, a whole lot of the crew went to Spud's Roadhouse to have a drink. I can't remember why I didn't join them. Perhaps we were doing some roadside mechanics at the time. There was certainly a bit of a wasted vibe from the crew that had been at the pub when we convened at Spud's, and we decided we needed to find somewhere very local to set up camp. Little did we know we weren't going to set up camp. We were in for a very long night.
And I saw people like beeping outside the camp. And I went closer and I said, oh, there's like 5 cars. I think you were there too. Yeah. And I was just watching what was happening. And I saw these people running away. Like there were like 30 people who ran from the fence. I think I was the last one. Yeah, I came out of the fence and I was like, uh-oh, no, no, go back. So I went back inside. I was like, no, 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 give it a try.
Just I want to tell to Australian people, please help us. We need freedom. We are is human. We are not animal. He born in this detention and he has stayed in this detention for 2 years. And every time these children are going to catch a friend and say, I need freedom. Where is the freedom? I don't know.
When you're in a medication for a couple of months, when you're in hunger struck, when you haven't eaten for 3 days, you don't really think properly. So I don't know what I was doing. Pretty much, yeah, I didn't know what to do, what I was doing. I was just left the camp and I jumped in the car and I find myself in the desert.
We drove in our ragtag convoy out of Spuds Roadhouse down the road towards Woomera to see what we could find in an assortment of miscellaneous vehicles, buses and trucks. As we neared the front gate of the detention centre, we noticed that the gates were open. This is an opportunity not to be missed, and we made a spontaneous decision to drive right on in. On a limb, we drove straight into the Woomera Detention Centre, past the perimeter gates, past the fence that had previously been toppled at the Easter breakout, and straight up to the main fence, where the refugees had escaped from previously. We began banging on the fence and calling out to see if anyone was inside. Minutes later, faces appeared out of the darkness.
30 people ran away. I came out of the fence and there was like 4 cars left. It was only 1 car was there. And because in Iran, the driver is the other side. Sorry, I went to the driver's side and it's like full. Yeah, Mrs. A said, jump in. So I sit on Mrs. A's lap, beautiful woman. And then we drive to the desert and we saw the cops were blocking the road, like there's 2 way rocks beyond to the Woomera, there's 2 way, the cops blocked it, and Miss A said, and they said, you get off and we come and pick you up in the morning. They said we come and pick you up in the sunrise, but my English wasn't good enough. I didn't know a sunrise is a sunset. I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna wait till another day.
Oh, no.
But they meant in the morning, they're gonna come in the morning, but I feel like they said they're coming in the afternoon. Anyway, yeah, I was there.
It just seemed like the thing to do. It was organic and spontaneous. And as those people came to the fence and put their hands through the bars, we saw eyes desperate and sad and glowing in the night, lips sewn together, children crying behind the fence. We could not walk away. We could not just get in our cars and go. It was only moments later that the two brothers made their way through the fence. Two young boys first out and ready, more than ready to come. As more and more people climbed through the fence, they ran and climbed into the vehicles. More and more people jumped in and said, take us away from here. My friend stood by her truck, 10 refugees in the back, a look of fear and confusion in her eyes. I'm here on a visa, she said. I don't know what to do. She gave me her truck keys and I jumped in the driver's seat. With my friend Nikki, R.I.P. She jumped in beside me, I revved the engine and pulled out. I couldn't work out how to get it out of third gear. The engine roared and we headed straight for the front gate. We didn't know where we were going. We had no idea what was going to happen. There was no plan, we just drove. The rest of the convoy followed. As we neared the front gate, security guards rushed out to shut the gate to prevent us from leaving. Another security guard jumped on the side of the truck, telling us to pull over. I had my left foot on the accelerator as I used my right foot to kick the door and to try and shake the security guard off it. I spun the truck 360 in a cloud of dust and freed ourselves from the unwanted barnacle. Suddenly, I remembered the back road out of the detention centre the police had taken me on when I was arrested there at Easter. And so we drove through the desert, dirt roads all the way to the highway. There, our vehicles split off in different directions in the darkness of the night, minds racing as we farewelled each other to uncertain fate.
Well, they dropped me off like maybe 1 case away from camp. I could see the Woomera's camp lights very little from far away. But I was, again, by myself. And once I went to the road and I said, oh, you know, that's not... Just go back to the Woomera. It's quite scary and you might get bitten by a snake and no one going to help you. I went to the road first and I waved to the trucks and no one literally stopped. I think they were scared, like, what the fuck? Who is the ghost or something? Because I was quite skinny and with these pajamas and like, ooh. So I waved to the trucks and no one stopped and I said, maybe just give it a try. And I like taking risk. So I'm a risk taker. So I said, that's all right. I have a bottle of water and 3 oranges from Miss A. So I went all the way to, I left the road, I went to the desert, and I saw this big helicopter coming. Massive helicopter, and having massive torch as well. So I was hiding under this beautiful Australian desert. I love the Australian desert. It was like a pile of bushy. And I went under, and this helicopter came with a big torch. It was like pure daytime. It was like 1 a.m. or something. And I hide there, and I had a phone, it's like an illegal phone, and the phone ringing. It's like, not a good time. There was an Afghani guy who said, oh, excellent, can I talk to Mr. Hussein? I was like, not now, I'm outside. He's like, oh, you're outside the camp or outside your room? I said, no, I'm outside the camp. I can't really talk. And the helicopter was like, top of my head. So I hang up and I turn off the phone and I hide under the bush and the helicopter left.
Wow.
So and I said, okay, yeah. Now is the time to find myself somewhere to sleep. So I found this little, like a bridge under the road. There's like 2 of them, it's a water channel, square one. So I went under and I'll start making a little fire. It's like, oh, I have a lighter, but I don't have a cigarette. And I think I made a little fire and it was so freezing. It was like June, July. Imagine how cold it is in desert in June, July. And my, the screen was literally frozen. And I had no clothes on. It was like a pyjamas. By the way, pyjamas is an Iranian word. Did you know? It originated in Iran. It's pyjama means from the clothes for old people.
Classic.
Yeah. I feel like very old when I wear pyjamas.
Yeah.
So I was there under the bridge. Be honest, I was scared of anything. Even the grass was moving. I was like, oh, what is this? It was just the grass. Like, I was scared of... I heard about the, you know, dingoes and snake, brown snake, spiders. But that time, again, my head, my brain was frozen. Mm. I wasn't even thinking. Like, I couldn't make decision. I just want to go with it.
Yeah.
Anyone you talk to about that night has a different crazy and equally outrageous story to tell. Somehow, some people made it to the lake, where they were hidden and kept safe with the support of kind-hearted local mob. Others didn't make it. I still have regrets. There are missing pieces of the puzzle, and I'm haunted by some of the decisions I made that night. The faces of people that you lost always stay with you. Maybe if I wasn't so determined, maybe if I slowed down or turned down that track, you never know. Cooper Pedy. Let's drive to Cooper Pedy. I know people there. There's lots of places to hide. It will take them a long time to find us. There's underground mines, abandoned, where you can hide people for years. Many people do so. Some of the most notorious characters in Cooper Pedy. I suspected most of them are on the run from all kinds of dodgy things, and somehow, in that lawless, dusty town, in underground bunkers, they continue to live their lives. It was this idea in the back of my mind that propelled me to drive north, to the land of holes and moonscapes.
Well, it was around, I think it was 6:30 a.m. The sun came up and it was start getting warm and the frozen, everything was frozen. And I couldn't sleep, like whole night I didn't sleep easy. I was just on the bridge and I was like scared, but I didn't want to go back that way to the camp. And it was like around 7, I heard a car was beeping. And that was the best beep. You know, usually you get annoyed by hearing the beep, but that was the first beep I actually liked it. And that was the best, one of the best moments I have in my life. And then I saw them and they ran to me and they hugged me and they put me in the back of the car mixed with the vegetables and they covered my head. And then we went middle of Australia. Yeah, that was the best, beautiful morning.
Wow, and where did they take you to?
I don't remember the name. I think it was like a little Aboriginal camp. And the beautiful Aboriginal man came to me and he gave me like a big postcard saying welcome. Oh. You know, I was touched. I was like, wow. Whew. Yeah, he said, welcome to our land. You know, you're safe here. So they took me. I met some of these beautiful people. And, yeah, I stay in the desert for another 5 days.
Nikki was fearless and wild, determined and dangerous, the right kind of person to be with for such an adventure. Like myself, the idea of breaking a law to help someone in need was not even questionable. Bad laws are made to be broken, and in the case of people being held hostage in a desert prison just for seeking asylum, there was no hesitation in what we were prepared to risk to right such a situation. One car went up ahead to check the road north. We met them by the roadside and they gave us the all clear. They turned back towards Port Augusta to find out what had become of our friends. We drove on into the night. It was 100 kilometres to the next town. We were running low on fuel. The servo was closed and the site was silent like a ghost town. There was no way we could get to Cooper Pedy with the fuel we had. From my faded memory, I think it was a septic truck parked near the public toilets. From further investigation, I found the fuel cap was unlocked. I consulted the guys about our predicament and rummaged around the back of the truck to find a hose. We found an angle grinder. And with the help of the guys, we stripped the wires out of the power lead and used it to siphon the diesel from the truck. We all took turns sucking the fuel through to get it going. It was a slow process, and I'm surprised we didn't draw attention to ourselves, but we managed to fill the tank and continue north. Adrenaline kept us going as signs for Cooper Pedy announced our arrival. There was an ominous feeling as the lights came into view, the lights of Cooper Pedy and the lights of a police roadblock. Okay, not good. I considered turning off at the mountain on the outskirts of town, where Auntie Irene Brown from the Cooper Pedy Kungajuta had showed us a super cool cave to camp in while we'd been in the hood doing nuke stuff. In retrospect, it would have been perfect, but we had come too close. I pulled over and went to the back of the truck. I told the guys about the roadblock and suggested it might be better to get out of the truck and walk around the roadblock and we will pick them up on the other side at the big wind generator. Suddenly, Nikki alerted us that the cop car was driving towards us. The guys jumped out and ran into the dark, cold night. Searchlights chased them. As I reached up to lock the door, a heavy hand grabbed my shoulder. "You're under arrest for aiding and abetting the escape of refugees," the officer said. "I was just taking a piss," I replied. He led me around to the front of the truck and told Nikki to turn off the motor. She jumped into the driver's seat. In a strange split-second moment, the policeman let go of my arm as he said to Nikki, "What are you doing?" "Just putting it out of gear," she said, with a twinkle in her eye. In a simultaneous moment, I jumped onto the truck and heaved myself Dukes of Hazzard style into the window as she slammed her foot on the accelerator and drove straight at the police roadblock. It was a battle of wills and ours were strong. Nikki was not slowing down and definitely not turning around. We were metres from slamming into the police cars that they had blocking the road and they reversed out of our way moments before we took them out. A car chase ensued and we turned off the road. I was familiar with the country and managed to guide us to the far side of town near Crocodile Harry's and lose the cops in the process. We rolled into an abandoned cave as we simultaneously ran out of fuel. We were safe-ish, but our new friends were still out there. My optimism has betrayed me again. I thought we could hide them in caves and our friends, activists and community in the area would help us unconditionally to help those in need. I was wrong. I thought maybe someone would help us pick up the guys at the wind generator. I thought people would let us use their cars and their phones to try and locate our friends amidst the minefields, help to hide them, feed them. But I was wrong. We had fucked up, and like the plague, no one wanted to touch us, let alone engage in the necessary rescue mission at hand. As the sun rose, we walked to town with jerry cans to get some fuel for the truck. We had to look for the people we had lost. We needed a vehicle, preferably not the one that had just run the roadblock. Unfortunately, when we met with people we knew, they didn't want anything to do with it, and we tried to find the guys on foot while we lugged our jerry cans down the road to no avail. A car pulled up with someone we knew, a guy who'd acquired the name Shaganrunika at camp after he'd eaten most of the kangaroo meant for everyone and proceeded to get on very loudly in his car at close quarters to the communal fire. He proceeded to lecture us on how we had jeopardised everyone's safety and no one wanted us to come to their houses or use their phones or be incriminated by association, and we'd better leave town immediately. He surprisingly offered us a lift. I was hoping he would drop the fuel off and go and search for people. The town was now crawling with cops and search helicopters, but instead of taking up the mission at hand, he decided to drive us out of town 50 k's, tailing us off the whole way, down the dirt track to Williams Creek, and told us to get out and hitch. And so, there we were, on the dirt track in the middle of the desert, with nothing but a jar of olives and not a car in sight. It was a fucking cold night, -3 degrees, I think. The liquid in our olive jar froze, and all we could do was feel shit and powerless, knowing the guys we lost were somewhere out there, somewhere freezing their asses off just like us, or already recaptured and sent back to Woomera. A lot had happened in 24 hours, and it wasn't over yet. There we were the next day, still there, waiting for our olives to melt. We hadn't seen a car since yesterday arvo. Dying out there was on the cards, when all of a sudden we saw a black dog. Not just any dog, it was Elvis. We followed Elvis back to the road, and there, taking a leak by the road, was our dear friend in his fire truck. We were saved by Elvis. We got lucky. The Elvis truck took us back to the lake, where we were reunited with old friends and new. Others went out in search of the rest, as there were friends scattered and stranded across the desert in different locations. Some people had been arrested, their vehicles confiscated. Others had hitched and found their way back to the lake. Others had made it out, and the people that were with them were now in hiding in our desert camp. More arrived with stories of escape and random moments of exceptional luck. Others of loss and confusion.
Anything, but everything was new for me, like the faces, the dog, the desert, the activists. But again, I didn't feel anything. I feel like a very comfortable norm. I just got to take it. That's how I said, okay, just take it. Whoever came, think about it. They're going to help you. They're not here to hurt you.
The days that followed involved much celebration, drinking, and even romance. Hiding in the soft sand of the creek bed, warm fires, cooking fresh kangaroo meat, and learning each other's stories. We did feel free for a moment. Moments don't last, but while it did, there was a magic between people. We were between worlds. DJ Mopsy had taken on the name of a prison guard he'd met at Woomera. As there was a big techno party for the eclipse coming up soon in the area, we thought he would pass as an Israeli DJ and proceeded to give him a makeover.
There was a guard, there was an officer in the Woomera named Mopsy. I think he was an English dude. He was very funny, but not very nice people. But he was, because he was funny, I was like, oh, that was a good name, Mopsy. So they said, let's call me a DJ Mopsy. And that's how, you know, if the cops came, I would say, I'm a DJ Mopsy, I'm an Israeli guy, I'm here for a doof-doof music. I remember you guys shaved top of my head, and the back of my hair became like a dread's hair. And I'm eating kangaroo. And Yeah, I think you guys were doing a bit of makeup on me. Like they put it, they go putting ash like from fire in my head. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe. But again, I wasn't thinking anything bad. I was thinking, just take it. They are here to help. They're not going to hurt you. Even the dog was sitting there, you know, he's here to help me. Everything was like, yeah, but I still feel trusted and just, yeah, trust the people around me.
It was those days we learnt the stories of the two brothers. They had the best grasp of English out of the guys and became the translators for the old Afghan men. They told us stories of how they had witnessed suicides. They had learned at a young age of 10 and 12 to cut themselves and drink shampoo. How they had been tear gassed and bore witness to violence on a daily basis. Like all moments, it passes, and the risk of being discovered grew. We had to make a move.
My name is Muntazir.
What do you think of your experience in the Woomera detention centre?
It is very horrible for children and families, for single men also, and there is no education and activities. And everyone get crazy there. Because of that we escaped. We was very tired and very fed up of the fences everywhere, from SEM, Dima. 3 times I killed myself by razor, and 2 times I suicided me. Then they took me. They was throwing in the camp. So everyone get crazy. Eyes was not working and we cannot breathe. And children and little boys, the smoke go in the eyes and when they breathe, it is very bad for their lungs.
The tear gas containers?
Yes.
Throw it in.
I'm very happy to be free. I want to go to school, read and learn English. In camp, we didn't learn English. We learned too many bad things. We learned how to cut themselves, how to drink shampoo, how to suicide. This. And when we get out of... Now we are free. Now we are free. Now we are free. Now we are free.
And so they left, some in the day and others under the cover of darkness from the creek bed, our temporary autonomous zone, to a diverse range of uncertain fates.
I can't remember the name of people, but they came and said, where do you want to go? Where do you like to go? There's Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne. But because when I was younger, I always heard about Melbourne, and it's a more arty city compared to this shitty city. So I said, I want to go to Melbourne. So there was me and another Iranian guy, Mehdi, and there was 2 young Afghanis, the Bakhtiari boys.
Yep.
They were with us as well, but not with me in the same car, but they came to Melbourne. So yeah, we came to Melbourne. And that was the start of a new chapter.
Yeah.
If will is an atheist prayer, then we were praying. Lake Eyre to Melbourne is a long way. To will oneself to safety. But unfortunately, safety is hard to find, even in a big city, as it was Cooper Pedy. Once again, we were scolded for our irresponsible behaviour by those we hoped would help us. We were all broke and homeless and now wanted for criminal offences, squatting and dumpstering, trying hard to support our new friends, but perhaps not so successfully.
From far away, it's like, oh, I'm in a Western country. But again, I didn't feel anything. I was just like, I'm again comfortably numb. That's what I would say. All the way, it just came, still everything new, everything was quite strange, like the people's look and, you know, and what they eat and Vegemite. It's like, really? You eat this?
Even I don't eat that.
No. I don't know. I don't understand Vegemite, really. No. But I respect them. They like it. Yeah, I think it was the first couple of weeks I was living in a different house for a couple of days, and then different house for a couple of days, living behind the cupboards, living with vegetarians, living with vegans. Like, what? You don't eat meat? No, we don't. And then I live with the different people. And it was interesting, you know, but I couldn't really say much because I couldn't speak much English, as you remember. I was saying, like this, like that. Yeah, I couldn't speak English, so I was just, it was hard to say. You got so much to say, you have to say, but you couldn't say it. And yeah, but I think it was, I was still comfortably numb.
Just
again.
Processing.
Yeah, taking it.
Still, you're still in shock from...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Still, I'm still... still past 20 years gone, still I am. Look, where are you?
It was the day some of our crew returned to the camp near the lake after delivering people to Melbourne that we heard the news. It was brought to us by a local cop. He smugly threw the newspaper down by our fire, made some snide comment to imply he knew it was us, and pointed to the photo. We all died inside as we saw the picture of the kids handcuffed and in tears being dragged from the British consulate. Return to Woomera, it said. I think we all cried. What the fuck? Why would someone take them there, leave them there alone to be returned to hell? We had come so far together, only now to be back where we started, with only an extra layer of despair. This is not how it was supposed to happen.
What I heard, it was an English embassy said, you can bring them there, trust me, we're going to help them. But when they took them to the English embassy, I think they betrayed the people and they took them to the camp again and sent them back to Afghanistan or Pakistan, I don't know.
I think that's what happened, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, we got back to camp and then we heard the news that they were back in Woomera and we were just devastated. We couldn't believe it. They'd come so far and then end up back where they started. I think we were all just crying, just like, what? Why? No, you know.
We all migrated back to the coast as the weather warmed. We stayed in contact with a lot of the guys that escaped. One by one, over the next 6 months, most people were recaptured and mostly released fairly quickly as Woomera closed and Baxter not long after. Some were returned to Afghanistan and Pakistan, but others stayed, and we are still friends today. Bonds form in hard times, never to be forgotten.
I think it was 3 years after, exact 3 years after I escaped. I talked to the lawyer and they said, you still have a chance for a humanitarian visa. So if you do the right things and give yourself, and then the lawyer would represent you, and then we can apply for a visa. I said, great. I don't really want to, but if it's the right things, then I have to do it. Then I'll give myself with the lawyer. We went to the immigration in Shiri, and then they put me in a van. They took me to the Maribyrnong Detention Center, which is the easy, I think it's the worst detention center, worse than Woomera. I'm not sure you've been to Maribyrnong. Yeah. But inside, terrible. They have like an underground shower, not clean. And they mixed up refugees or asylum seekers with over visas and drug dealers. And, you know, the American, they got like fully tattoos and they're wild people. There was I was there for, can't remember, for a couple of weeks. Then I got crazy Macedonian guy. He was like fucked in the head. He just came in out of the blue and just punched me in the face and broke my ribs, broke my nose. My nose was already big, now it's bigger. Thank you. So yeah, he broke my nose and broke my number 6 and 8 ribs. And then for my safety, they put me in the car, 13 hours drive with the broken ribs, They took me to Port Augusta Detention Center because Woomera wasn't there anymore. Woomera was destroyed. So, yeah, they took me back to where I was started. Some of the guard would see, like, Trevor. He's like a big head guard. He said, oh, I know, I remember you. You came back now. So they put me, again, they put me in a little room. But this time I could speak English a little bit. Before I couldn't say any words. Yeah, I went back again for 6 months, I think I was there. And that was hard because I saw outside, and then you, like a bird, you let him fly and then you put him back again to the cage. That's bad. If you haven't seen outside, then you say, oh, okay, that's how it is. Yeah, it was hard. But again, I have to do it. I remember I went back to Baxter and then I saw this guy. By the time I went back, he was there like 6 years. Yeah, and he has a long hair. He got there, he was 19. But when I met him the second time in Baxter, he was like 26. And he wouldn't even talk. He was like a frozen head. And he looks like a Syd Barrett from, you know, Syd Barrett from Pink Floyd. He looks like Syd Barrett a bit. Like, literally, frozen head. And I said, do you remember me? He's like, yeah, I remember your face, but, you were the footballer. I said, yeah, that was me. He came back. I said, yeah, but he was very slow talking. Before, he was very energetic. He was climbing the wall, you know, very, and now, but back then, he wasn't. So I saw him. I saw a couple of guys from, like, way before, from 1998, 1999, they came to Woomera. They were still there. And I'm so amazed I met you, and I met beautiful people like yourself, and I wouldn't be here if it wasn't because of you guys. So thank you from my heart. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And you know, you always wonder if you're doing the right thing, you know, and especially with refugee advocacy and stuff like that, you go, am I doing the right thing? Am I putting this person in a worse situation or a better situation? But you can only act from your heart, I guess. And sometimes people tell you, you shouldn't have done that or you should have done this or that kind of thing. And I think in the spur of the moment, like when you came out, it was like, we didn't know what we were doing either, you know, we were all just finding our way. Together, accidentally, just acting from our hearts, maybe not from our brains, but definitely from our hearts. And so, you know, it was a very spontaneous adventure. And I think we're all still processing. I think we're all still in shock from I guess, the trauma of witnessing what was happening to you guys, as well as what you guys went through and what we went through together.
Yeah, I think it's... I don't think you did the wrong things. You did the right things, and if I was in Iran and you came to Iran as a refugee, I would do exactly the same. But I wouldn't probably put a Vegemite in front of you.
Good, I'm glad. Instead, we have a lovely spread of avocado, salami, olives, and cheese, and hummus. So.
Yay!
Yay! Thank you.
Woomera Stories was produced on the stolen land of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty never ceded.